A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about the Israel Air Force fleet, how it's evolved over the decades, the different types flying now, and just how extensive the modifications have been. And the big question, has it always been American jets, or did Israel ever actually build its own fighter plane? There's a lot to unpack here. I mean, you could teach a whole course on this.
You really could. And the short answer to the domestic production question is, yes, they did build their own. But the story of how they got there is basically a heist film with afterburners. It's one of the most extraordinary aircraft development paths of any air force in the world.
A heist film? I'm already interested.
Let me set the stage. The Israel Air Force starts in 1948, right at independence. Their first combat aircraft were literally smuggled out of Czechoslovakia. Avia S-199s, which were license-built Messerschmitt Bf-109s. Think about that. A Jewish air force flying a Nazi-designed fighter assembled in Czechoslovakia rushed into combat against Egyptian Spitfires. The first kills were scored by Modi Alon in June 48, shooting down two Egyptian C-47s over Tel Aviv. 4 days later, he got two more.
Messerschmitts defending Tel Aviv. That's the kind of historical irony you can't make up. And that patchwork beginning, smuggled planes, whatever they could get their hands on, that scarcity mindset never really left, did it?
It's the through line of the entire story. The early fleet was a museum of whatever was available. Spitfires, P-51 Mustangs, Mosquitoes, even B-17 bombers they acquired by essentially creating fake front companies and flying them out of the United States through a series of shell games. By the mid-50s, they standardized on French jets. Dassault Oregons, then Mystères, then Super Mystères. The French were the primary supplier for about 15 years.
This is where the relationship gets complicated, because France was all in, until they suddenly weren't.
De Gaulle imposed an arms embargo in 1967, right before the Six-Day War. Overnight, the Israel Air Force's supply chain evaporated. They'd already paid for 50 Mirage 5Js, customized to Israeli specifications with simplified avionics for desert operations, more fuel capacity, more weapons stations, and France just refused to deliver them. The plane sat in France.
What does a small country do when its primary supplier cuts it off and the neighbors are mobilizing? You mentioned a heist.
The heist was actually the boats, the 5 missile boats in Cherbourg that Israel literally stole on Christmas Eve 1969. But for the aircraft, the approach was different. It was espionage. Through a network of contacts, Israel obtained the complete blueprints for the Mirage 5. Some sources say through Alfred Frauenknecht, a Swiss engineer who was eventually caught and imprisoned. Others point to cooperation with Dassault engineers who were sympathetic. Either way, Israel got the plans.
Obtained the complete blueprints. Is doing a lot of work there. So they had the plans for a plane. France wouldn't sell them. What did they do with them?
They built it themselves. That became the IAI Nesher, Hebrew for Eagle. First flight in 1971, entered service in 1972, just in time for the Yom Kippur War in 1973. The Nesher was essentially an unlicensed Mirage 5 built by Israel Aerospace Industries, and it performed brilliantly. Over 100 kills during the Yom Kippur War. It was Israel saying, "We will never be in that position again."
A plane born of spite and necessity. Those tend to be the interesting ones.
The Nesher was just the beginning. While they were building it, they were already working on the next step, what became the IAI KFAR Lion Cub. This is where the story gets genuinely impressive from an engineering standpoint. They took the Mirage airframe, which was designed for the French Atar 9C engine, and they decided to re-engine it with the American General Electric J-79, the same engine powering the F-4 Phantom. But the J-79 was larger, heavier, had different airflow requirements, and ran hotter. So they essentially had to redesign the entire rear fuselage.
Which is the kind of modification that makes aerospace engineers wake up in a cold sweat. You're not just swapping a part. You're rebuilding the thing.
New engine intakes, new cooling systems, reinforced structure, revised aerodynamics. The Kafer ended up being shorter but wider than the Mirage, with canards added for improved maneuverability. It was faster, Mach 2.3 versus the Mirage's Mach 2.2, and could carry a heavier payload. First flight in 1973, operational by 1976. This was a new aircraft, not just a copy.
Israel went from having no domestic aircraft industry to, in about 8 years, fielding an indigenous fighter that was competitive with anything in the region. That's an astonishing industrial sprint.
And the Kafir served as the backbone of the IAF's ground attack squadrons for decades. They built over 200 of them. Exported to Ecuador, Colombia, Sri Lanka. Ecuador still flies them, by the way. The Kafir was also adapted into a reconnaissance variant, the Kafir Tselem, and even a two-seat trainer. But here's where the story takes another turn. The Americans had entered the picture.
Because the Kafir's engine was American, which created a dependency of its own.
And the United States was not thrilled about Israel exporting a fighter that competed with American products, powered by an American engine. There was pressure to limit Kafir exports. Meanwhile, the U.S. had started supplying Israel with frontline American fighters. First the A-4 Skyhawk, then the F-4 Phantom, and then the game changer, the F-15 Eagle.
The F-15 is still flying today. It's one of those platforms that just refuses to age out.
104-0. That's the F-15's air-to-air kill ratio. It has never been shot down in air combat. Israel received its first F-15s in 1976, the F-15 A and B models, and they were operational by 1978. The IAF now flies the F-15, IRAM, which is a heavily modified strike variant specific to Israel. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let me lay out the current fleet.
I want the full picture.
The IAF today operates roughly 500 to 600 aircraft, depending on how you count trainers and transports. The combat fleet is built around three pillars. First, the F-15, they fly about 50 F-15, IROMs, plus another 30 or so older F-15 A, B, C, and D models that have been continuously upgraded. The RAM is a two-seat long-range strike fighter with conformal fuel tanks, Israeli avionics, Israeli electronic warfare systems, and the ability to carry precision-guided munitions at ranges that reach, well, let's just say, regional distances.
The diplomatic way of saying Tehran.
I didn't say that, you did. The second pillar is the F-16. Israel operates the largest F-16 fleet outside the United States, over 200 aircraft across multiple variants. They've got the F-16 Isufa, which is another heavily customized two-seat strike variant, plus F-16C and D Baraks. The Sufa has conformal fuel tanks, Israeli-designed avionics, Israeli helmet, mounted queuing systems, Israeli electronic warfare suites. In fact, the IAF's F-16. I was the first F-16 variant to feature conformal fuel tanks anywhere in the world. Lockheed Martin later adopted the concept for other customers.
The student becomes the teacher. So Israel is not just buying American planes. They're co-developing features that end up in the global product line.
That brings us to the third and newest pillar, the F-35. Israel was the first country outside the United States to receive the F-35A, the Adir, Mighty One, in December 2016. They currently operate about 39, with a total planned fleet of 75. And here's the thing that makes the Israeli F-35 unique. It's the only F-35 variant in the world that has been modified to incorporate Israeli electronic warfare systems, Israeli communication systems, and Israeli weapons integration. The U.S. doesn't normally let anyone touch the F-35 source code. Israel got an exception.
How did they manage that? The F-35 software is famously locked down. Other allies have been told no.
Persistent, high-level negotiation over years. The argument was essentially, we face threats that no other F-35 operator faces, with reaction times measured in seconds, not hours, and we need the jet to talk to our existing command and control networks. The U.S. agreed to let Israel install a plug-and-play architecture that allows Israeli-made systems to interface with the jet without compromising the core American software. It's unprecedented. The Adir also carries Israeli-developed external fuel tanks. The F-35 isn't designed for external tanks, but Israel needed the range.
Even the most locked-down American fighter ever built gets the Israeli modification treatment. That's a pattern. What else is in the fleet?
On the rotary side, they've got about 50 AH-64 Apache attack helicopters, both the A model, called the Petan, and the D model, the Seraph. The Seraph is another Israeli special with custom avionics and weapons integration. They also fly UH-60 Blackhawks for transport and special operations, and a fleet of older CH-53C Stallions, the Yasser, that have been so heavily upgraded over 50 years of service that they're practically new helicopters. New engines, new avionics, new composite rotor blades. The airframes are from the 1960s, but everything inside is 21st century.
The Yasser is basically the helicopter of Theseus. At what point is it a different aircraft?
That's a philosophical question. The IAF maintenance depots probably don't have time to ponder. They're also flying the Eitan, the Heron TP drone, which is a massive unmanned aerial vehicle with the wingspan of a 737, and a whole family of smaller UAVs for surveillance and strike, plus the usual transport fleet, C-130 Hercules, C-130J, Super Hercules, Boeing 707s converted for aerial refueling, and a fleet of trainer aircraft like the M-346 Labai.
Now there's a name that deserves its own chapter.
This is the answer to the other half of Daniel's question, the truly domestically produced plane. In the 1980s, Israel decided to develop a fully indigenous fighter to replace the Kfir and eventually the Skyhawk. The IAI Levi Young Lion was an ambitious project, a single-engine, delta-wing, fly-by-wire, multi-role fighter. It borrowed some technology from the F-16, which the U.S. had shared under the Foreign Military Sales Program, but the design was Israeli. First flight in December 1986.
It was actually good?
By all accounts, it was excellent. Test pilots said it was a joy to fly. Advanced aerodynamics, an American P and W-1120 engine, Israeli radar, and avionics. But the project became politically toxic. The cost was ballooning, and the U.S. saw it as a threat to American fighter exports. The Reagan administration pressured Israel heavily to cancel the program, arguing that it was cheaper to buy F-16s off the shelf. The Israeli cabinet voted on it in August 1987. The vote was 12-11 in favor of cancellation.
So, Israeli fighter development died by a single cabinet minister's decision. What happened to the Lavi prototypes?
Two flew. A third was under construction. The technology didn't go to waste. A lot of the avionics and systems work fed into upgrades for existing aircraft, and some of it was sold to China, which is a whole other geopolitical story. China's J-10 fighter has design elements that many analysts trace back to Lavi technology transferred in the 1990s.
Of course it does. The Lavi dies, and its DNA ends up in the People's Liberation Army Air Force. That's the most Israeli outcome possible.
It really is. But there's a broader point here. The Lavi cancellation cemented Israel's dependence on American platforms. Since 1987, the IAF has not attempted a clean sheet fighter design. Instead, Israel perfected a different model, take an American airframe, and rebuild it from the inside out.
Which is arguably smarter, if less romantic. Why spend $20 billion developing a new plane when you can take the world's best fighter and make it better for your specific needs?
That's exactly what they've done. The modifications are so extensive that an Israeli F-16I shares only about 60% of its systems with the standard American F-16 Block 52. The Israeli version has a different radar warning receiver, different electronic countermeasures, different communication suite, different weapons integration software, different cockpit displays, and it can carry Israeli-designed weapons like the Python, 5 air-to-air missile, the Derby Beyond, visual range missile, the Spice precision-guided glide bomb, and the Delilah loitering munition.
The Delilah is an interesting one. It's essentially a cruise missile drone hybrid, a loitering munition that can be retargeted in flight.
It was developed from a target drone. Israel has a habit of turning target drones into offensive weapons. The Harop and Harpy loitering munitions, the whole family of IAI, developed systems that pioneered the category. These integrate directly with the modified F-16s and F-15s. So an Israeli F-16 isn't just a bomb truck for American weapons, it's a node in an Israeli-designed kill chain.
Let's talk about that modification philosophy more broadly. Because it's not just avionics and weapons, the IAF has done structural work too, right?
Massive structural modifications. The F-15 IROM has a different wing structure to accommodate the conformal fuel tanks and Israeli-designed pylons. The F-16 Isufa has a dorsal avionics compartment that no other F-16 has, housing Israeli electronic warfare systems. The CH-53 Yasser upgrade program, called Yasser 2025, replaced the engines, the transmission, the rotor blades, the cockpit, the navigation systems, and the self-protection suite. The only original part is the airframe, and even that has been reinforced and life extended.
There is something distinctly Israeli about that approach. The outside looks the same, but everything that matters has been replaced. It's the aircraft equivalent of a building in Tel Aviv, where the facade is preserved Ottoman stone, but the inside is a tech startup.
And it works because Israel has a world-class aerospace engineering sector. IAI, Elbit Systems, Rafael, these companies don't just assemble parts. Elbit builds helmet-mounted display systems that are used by F-35 pilots worldwide. Rafael builds the David Sling and Iron Dome interceptors. The Python 5 missile is considered one of the best short-range air-to-air missiles on the planet. So when Israel modifies an American jet, they're not just tinkering. They're integrating systems that are at or above the level of what they're replacing.
This brings us back to the evolution question. If you map the IAF's fleet over time, what's the shape of that curve?
It's a story in four chapters. Chapter 1, 1948 to 1967, the scavenging era. Whatever they could get, Czech, British, French, American surplus. No standardization, desperate improvisation. Chapter 2, 1967 to 1987, the French rupture and the rise of indigenous design. The Nesher and Kefir are born, and American platforms start arriving. The F-4 Phantom becomes the heavy hitter, the A-4 Skyhawk, the workhorse, the F-15, the air superiority king. Chapter 3, 1987 to 2016, the American standardization era. The lobby is cancelled, and the IAF goes all in on the F-15 and F-16, with Israeli modifications getting deeper and deeper. Chapter 4, 2016 to present, the stealth era and the drone revolution. The F-35 enters service, unmanned systems multiply, and the fleet becomes a networked whole rather than a collection of individual platforms.
That fourth chapter is the one that doesn't get enough attention. The F-35 gets the headlines, but the real transformation is how everything talks to everything else.
The IAF was an early adopter of network-centric warfare. They demonstrated it in Operation Orchard in 2007, the strike on the Syrian nuclear reactor. That mission involved F-15s and F-16s penetrating Syrian airspace, with electronic warfare aircraft jamming Syrian radar in real time, while the target was being illuminated by, allegedly, Israeli special forces on the ground. The Syrian Air Defense Network, Russian-built, quite sophisticated, never saw them coming. The IAF essentially hacked an entire country's radar system.
You're being careful.
Some details are still classified, but the point stands, the IAF's edge isn't just the aircraft. It's the integration, the way Israeli electronic warfare, Israeli intelligence, Israeli precision munitions, and Israeli modified platforms combine into a single system. The plane is just the delivery mechanism.
When we talk about the Israel Air Force fleet, we're really talking about a layered ecosystem. American airframes, Israeli brains, and a doctrine that treats the whole thing as a single weapon.
That ecosystem has been tested. The IAF has fought in multiple wars, conducted countless strikes in Syria, Gaza, Lebanon, and further afield. It maintains a tempo that few other air forces match. American F-16 pilots who train with the IAF consistently say the Israelis fly more aggressively, with tighter rules of engagement, and in more complex threat environments than almost anyone else. The U.S. Air Force sends squadrons to train in Israel specifically to learn how they operate.
What about the future? Is the F-35 the end of the modification era, or is Israel already working on its own sixth-generation concepts?
The F-35 will be the backbone for decades, and the modifications will continue. There's already talk of integrating Israeli-directed energy weapons when those mature. But Israel is also developing the next generation of unmanned combat air vehicles. The IAITS AD, a stealthy, autonomous, loyal wingman drone designed to fly alongside the F-35, has been in development. The idea is that a single F-35 pilot could control a swarm of unmanned aircraft, each carrying sensors or weapons, multiplying the formation's capability without risking additional pilots.
The loyal wingman concept. Everyone's working on it. The Americans have the Collaborative Combat Aircraft Program. The Australians have the MQ-28 Ghost Bat. The Russians and Chinese have their own versions. Where does Israel fit?
Israel hasn't announced an operational loyal wingman yet, but given their track record with drones and their need to maximize every platform, they're almost certainly further along than they're showing. The SEAD has been test flown. IAI has also shown concepts for a larger unmanned strike platform. The direction of travel is clear, fewer manned platforms, more autonomous systems, tighter networking.
The manned side? Any appetite for another attempt at a domestic fighter?
The economics don't work. Developing a fifth or sixth generation fighter costs tens of billions. The F-35 program was over $400 billion. Even a smaller country's fighter program, like South Korea's KF-21, cost around $8 billion. Israel's defense budget is about $23 billion annually. They can't afford a clean-sheet fighter and don't need one when they have deep access to the F-35 and can modify it more than anyone else.
The Lavi was the first and last truly Israeli fighter. That one-vote margin in 1987 really was the fork in the road.
But here's the counterpoint. If the Lavi had survived, Israel might have a domestically produced fighter today, but it would have cost so much that other capabilities would have suffered. The Iron Dome might not exist. The drone programs might have been starved. The choice to cancel the Lavi and invest in modifications, missiles, air defense, and unmanned systems might have been, strategically, the right call, even if it stung.
That's the tension at the heart of this whole story. Independence versus pragmatism. The Kfir and Nesher were born because Israel had no choice. The Lavi was cancelled because Israel had a choice. And that choice led to a deeper partnership with the United States that, for all its constraints, has produced the most capable air force in the Middle East.
The constraints are real. Every major Israeli operation still depends on American supplied platforms and, in some cases, American supplied munitions. The IAF can't fight a prolonged campaign without resupply from the U.S. That's the vulnerability that the Lavi was supposed to address. It wasn't solved, it was managed.
Managed through the modification philosophy. If you can't build the whole plane, you build everything that goes inside it. The radar, the electronic warfare suite, the missiles, the command and control network. That way, even an American jet becomes, operationally, an Israeli weapon system.
That's the quiet victory of the IAF's approach. No one else modifies American fighters to this degree. Not the Japanese, not the South Koreans, not the British. Israel has a unique status, a kind of privileged tinkerer. The U.S. trusts Israel enough to give them access, and Israel is capable enough to do something with it. It's a relationship built on decades of demonstrated competence and shared strategic interests.
Let me ask you the question. Daniel didn't ask, but that's hovering over this whole discussion. How good is the IAF, actually? Not on paper, in reality.
The operational record speaks for itself. In the Six-Day War, Operation Focus destroyed over 400 Arab aircraft, most of them on the ground, in the first 3 hours. In the Yom Kippur War, the IAF shot down about 277 enemy aircraft for the loss of, depending on the source, between 5 and 15 in air-to-air combat. Operation Mole Cricket, 19 in 1982. The IAF destroyed 19 Syrian surface-to-air missile batteries in the Bekaa Valley in about 2 hours, while shooting down 82 Syrian fighters with zero air-to-air losses. That's not a typo. 82 to zero.
82 to zero is the kind of statistic that sounds made up until you check it.
It's been replicated in smaller engagements since. The IAF hasn't lost an air-to-air engagement in over 40 years. The last acknowledged loss was in 1982, and even that is disputed. They've maintained air superiority in every conflict. The real threat to Israeli aircraft has been surface-to-air missiles, not enemy fighters. The Syrians shot down a few Israeli jets with SA-5 and SA-6 missiles in the 1970s and 80s. An F-16 was lost to a Syrian SA-5 in 2018. The pilot survived, the weapons systems officer was killed. Those losses hurt, but they're rare.
The strategic reach? Everyone talks about the long arm, but how long is it really?
The F-15, IROM, has an unrefueled combat radius of well over 1,000 nautical miles, and with aerial refueling, which the IAF practices constantly, it can reach anywhere in the Middle East and beyond. The F-35 Adir, with external tanks, extends that further. The IAF's modified 707 tankers give them a global reach if they have overflight permissions or staging bases. They've struck targets in Sudan, in Tunisia, the PLO headquarters in 1985, Operation Wooden Leg, one of the longest-range strike missions in history at the time. They've operated over Iran, over Iraq. The Osirak reactor strike in 1981, Operation Opera, used F-16s with F-15s flying top cover, a 16-aircraft package that flew over 800 miles each way through Saudi and Jordanian airspace undetected.
Undetected because they flew in tight formation to appear as a single large blip on radar. That's the kind of tactical creativity that defines the IAF.
They did it with F-16s that had only been delivered a few months earlier. The jets had barely finished their acceptance checks. That's the operational tempo we're talking about. New aircraft, new pilots, new mission profile. And they pulled it off.
When you look at the fleet today, F-15s, F-16s, F-35s, Apaches, Blackhawks, the drone swarms, the tankers, the trainers. What's the one thing people get wrong about it?
That it's just an American proxy air force. That Israel flies whatever Washington lets them have, and that's the end of the story. The reality is that the IAF is one of the most innovative modification and integration organizations in aviation history. They've taken American hardware and turned it into something uniquely Israeli. The Kfir, the Nesher, the Lavi, those were expressions of a deeper capability that never went away. It just changed form. Today's IAF doesn't build airframes, it builds capability.
The airframe is just the bus. Everything that matters is what you plug into it.
Who's flying it? The IAF pilot selection and training pipeline is notoriously brutal. About 1 in 10 applicants makes it through. The training syllabus includes air-to-air combat, air-to-ground, electronic warfare, and survival training that goes well beyond what most NATO air forces require. Israeli pilots fly more hours per year than almost any other air force, around 250 hours annually for active combat pilots compared to about 180 to 200 for U.S. Air Force pilots. They train like they fight, and they fight frequently.
That's the other piece people miss. The IAF isn't a parade force. It's in constant, low-visibility combat. Strikes in Syria, interdictions, intelligence-gathering missions. The fleet doesn't get to rest.
Which is why the maintenance and modification infrastructure is so critical. The IAF's technical depots at Tel Naf and elsewhere are capable of depot-level maintenance and major structural modifications that most air forces would send back to the manufacturer for. They've developed life extension programs for aging aircraft that Boeing and Lockheed Martin engineers have studied. When the CH-53 needed new rotor blades, Israel designed and manufactured them domestically. When the F-16 needed a new electronic warfare suite, Elbit built one that outperformed the American original.
The story of the IAF fleet is really the story of Israeli industry as a whole. Start with nothing, get cut off, improvise, learn by doing, and eventually build something better than what you were buying in the first place.
Never, ever assume the supply chain will be there tomorrow. That's the scar tissue from 1967. Every IAF commander since has operated with the assumption that resupply could stop at any moment. That's why the weapons stockpiles are deep, the domestic production lines are maintained, and the modifications never stop. It's not paranoia, it's institutional memory.
Institutional memory, backed by a lot of very creative engineering. The Kfir is still the emblem of that for me. Take a French airframe, stuff an American engine in it, redesign half the fuselage, add canards, and produce a fighter that's still flying combat missions in South America 50 years later. That's not copying. That's reinvention.
The Kfir story isn't over. IAI has proposed a Kfir Block 60 upgrade with an active electronically scanned array radar, new avionics, and new weapons integration for existing operators. The airframe is old, but the systems keep getting younger. It's the same philosophy applied to the F-16 and F-15, continuous evolution rather than periodic replacement.
To circle back to Daniel's original questions, the fleet has evolved from a patchwork of smuggled surplus to a highly modified American standardized force backed by an emerging unmanned component. The modifications are among the most extensive of any air force. And yes, Israel built its own fighters, the Nesher, the Kfir, and the Lavi. but the Larvae was the last clean sheet design, cancelled by one vote in 1987. Since then, the strategy has been to take the world's best platforms and make them Israeli from the inside out.
That's the summary. One thing I'd add, the next decade is going to be about the drones. The F-35 will remain the tip of the spear, but the mass of the force is going to shift toward unmanned systems. The IAF has been the world leader in military drone operations for 30 years. That institutional knowledge is going to compound as autonomy improves. The loyal wingman concept, swarming munitions, autonomous surveillance grids, Israel is positioned to lead in all of it.
The modification philosophy scales perfectly to unmanned systems. If you're already comfortable ripping out the avionics of an F-15 and replacing them with your own, doing the same thing to a drone is straightforward.
The hard part, the systems integration, the electronic warfare, the networking, is the same skill set applied to a different platform. Israel doesn't need to build the airframe, it needs to build the brain.
Which is a good place to leave it. The IAF fleet is a physical manifestation of a strategic doctrine. Never be dependent, never stop improving, and always assume the next war starts tomorrow.
Never forget that one vote in a cabinet meeting can change the course of an entire industry. That's the lobby lesson. It hangs over every procurement decision to this day.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Namib Desert's characteristic orange-red dunes owe their color to a thin coating of iron oxide on the sand grains, but the shade varies subtly by region. Dunes near Sossusvlei contain higher concentrations of hematite, giving them a deeper crimson hue compared to the more goethite-rich dunes further north, which lean toward ochre. This pigment variation is essentially a mineralogical fingerprint of the dune's source rock.
The Namib Desert is basically a giant Pantone swatch book.
Hematite and goethite. I'll never look at a dune the same way.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumintop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy the show, leave us a review. It helps. We'll see you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.